I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How you doing today, Matt?
I have been possessed by the spirit of a pair of armor. Shoulders, particularly.
Alright, well, I am not possessed, and therefore I will continue leading this endeavor. We are going to be answering more of your questions. We actually have quite a bit of them, including one that is absolutely massive, so we have no clue how long that's going to take, but thank you very much for sending that in, and I'll give a shout-out to Matt Damon for that. Not the Matt Damon, Matt Demon. So make sure there's a distinction there. But if you have questions for this podcast or the other one, be sure to go ahead and send them into podcast@blizzardwatch.com, or you can go ahead and throw them into our Patreon and the Patreon supporter Q and podcast questions channel. We do tend to look there. As a matter of fact, most of the other questions we have here in this week's selection all come from that particular channel. If you don't have Patreon, we understand things are tight. You can always send us that email, or we do have one for Q questions on our Discord, in which we do look for podcast questions after we look at the other places. So be sure to send those in. We're going to start off with the ones from Matt Damon today. Matt, just so you know, that was a wonderfully large selection. I'm not going to read the entirety of the email, and instead I'm going to skip directly to the questions, just because we'd be here all day, and, well, as much as we appreciate it, we want to get to the meat of it. So the first question from Matt here, are we sure that Titans can even be corrupted? Azeroth herself has even been touched directly by old gods for untold amounts of time. Seeing as Yashiraj brought up blood when yanked out, and the other old gods weren't killed the same way because of the same reason, and we know even sleeping world souls seem resistant to the whispering of multiple old gods because Azeroth herself has been in contact with the speaker and Magni seems okay for now. Sure, things may change in the future, but as for what is in-game, I'm not seeing anything that shows Titans can be corrupted by the Void. Fell, maybe, because of Sargeras, but that's different.
Well, if you only accept evidence specifically from World of Warcraft, then that is the case. However, if you go by Chronicle, the book that they put out that contains the history of their setting, yes, we know that Titans can be corrupted because Sargeras came upon a world that was in the process and destroyed it before it could finish. He certainly seemed to believe that they could be corrupted. Being a Titan, one suspects he might have more insight into it than, say, we do. But I will give you that we did not actually see a Void Titan. Because waiting to actually get the Void Titan, probably not a good move. And the fact that the Titans themselves seemed pretty concerned about all the old gods infesting Azeroth, and when they discovered they couldn't just kill them, deliberately imprisoned them, put them into like various forms of containment, implies that they saw some kind of concern. There's something about this process that is bad, and they don't want it to continue. but we've never, it's sort of like asking, how do we know that this knife will kill you? I've never seen you die from a knife wound. Fair enough, but I'm not going to let you stab me to find out. That's kind of how the way this works. There's never been an actual Void Titan in the game. We've never actually seen a Void Titan. So as far as that goes, yeah, we've never seen one corrupted. To be honest, we don't know that we've ever seen Sargeras corrupted by Fel. He's affected by Fel.
He certainly doesn't look green when we pull him back off of Azeroth.
Well, but that's not even the thing. Yes, he's been using Fel and he's got demonic servants and all that, but how has it changed his outlook? It hasn't. Sargeras' mindset, he decided after he destroyed the world that was being corrupted by old gods, he decided that things had to be done a certain way. This had nothing to do with Fel. Like, the Fel didn't make him make that decision. And everything he's done since has been the same. I mean, and look at when we see Agrimmar. When he gets his hands on Agrimmar and they quote-unquote break him, Agrimmar doesn't become different physically. I mean, the avatar of Agrimmar that we see and fight looks like Agrimmar. So I don't think corruption is the issue here. Titans can just have enormous power. Even if nothing changes about the Titan, when the Void entities get done with it, when the old gods get done whispering in it, even if Azeroth isn't physically changed, she can make bad decisions. I mean, Sargeras certainly made bad decisions. So I don't know if they're worried about it in the sense of like, you know, ooh, now she's going to have tentacles. I think they're worried about it in the sense of now she will decide that the Void is right. Yeah. And put all the power of a Titan behind that.
Yeah. And I think that's usually my sticking point when it comes to stuff like this, is the term corruption can mean a lot of things contextually. And I'm going to argue that we've already seen some of that effect in-game, in particular with Azeroth, while walking alongside of Magni. So Azeroth is not okay. Like, straight up, we know that. And I'm not just talking about the bleeding wound from Battle for Azeroth, the blood fissures coming up all over the planet. Yeah, those are physical traumas. But don't forget, when we go to Ulduar, at one point during all of that questing, throughout everything that we do, and what is happening? Azeroth is having a nightmare. That nightmare is manifesting itself as void tentacles and void creatures and beings of shadow. There's already an influence being had. Yes, there might be some natural resistance to a change of nature based off of being a Titan. Like Matt's pointed out, Sargeras' mindset hasn't really changed much from using Fel from what he was before he started using Fel, which is, this is my course of action. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a more subtle influence. I'd argue, going back even further, we can see how they've already had that idea in game when you start talking about Medivh and Egwene, and you start talking about how her decision-making process was shifted ever so subtly using her natural inclinations by the little seed of Sargeras growing inside of her. And the same thing happened with Medivh. The same thing could happen with a Titan, where maybe a whisper here or a touch here plays off of a natural inclination of what that Titan is and makes them do something extreme as a result. We don't even know what Azeroth is, quote unquote, a Titan of yet. We know that we have like A&R with life, and we have Amon Thul with his time magic and everything else. They all seem to have their specialties. What's Azeroth's? What could that mean if there's that little tiny whisper, that little tiny influence telling her to do something extreme, or telling her to do something just a little bit extra than what she normally would, and causing a whole bunch of stuff to go sideways? It also becomes like a matter of scale, right? Like, if you as a person are told to do something or push in a direction that makes you do something that you wouldn't normally do, maybe, you know, try a new sandwich or whatever, and it doesn't turn out to be something good, it's not really that big of a deal. That's sort of small scale. These are cosmic beings or entities of enormous power, of which you've pointed out here, that when they are influenced to do something possibly outside of their norm, or maybe to an extreme of their norm, that could have potentially catastrophic results. Let's go back to Sargeras on that. Sargeras, even if he's resistant to whatever's happened with him, even if he's being subtly pushed by the whispers of the Nathrezim, or being pushed by the whispers of Kil'jaeden, being pushed in a direction that he normally maybe would hesitate a little bit or not go as far or extreme, maybe that makes him go just that extra step further. Maybe that's why he stabbed Azeroth on his way out, because maybe he wouldn't normally do that. Maybe he would still try to salvage the operation in some capacity, or believe that somebody under his employ is going to continue his crusade to bring Azeroth to his side. No, he shoves a giant sword into her. Maybe that isn't what he would normally do, considering he spent all this time trying to bring Azeroth to his side, to bring it into the fold, just like he did all the other Titans. One could argue that maybe it's not a corruption in the sense that, like, Azeroth is going to grow to be like an old god, but it's just what they can do. And we've seen N'Zoth have an insane amount of that influence already. We've seen the old gods be able to do that with things that aren't Titans. Who's to say that these things buried into Azeroth's flesh, essentially, whispering in her dreams for all this time, wouldn't have an impact? We don't know. And that's part of what I take umbrage with when people like focus on corruption as like a physical manifestation. Corruption just means deviation from a chosen path, or deviation from essentially what you are programmed to do. When a program becomes corrupted, it's because it's no longer doing what you want it to do. That's kind of the same thing that I look at here. And we may never know.
To jump back in here for a second.
Go for it.
One of the things that happens when we confront Algolon, who is a servant of the Titans, and he says, perhaps it is your imperfections, that which grants you free will. That implies that Titan creations, at least, don't have free will.
Yeah.
And here's the thing about the Titans. They are exceptionally orderly beings. Now, think about Sargeras. Sargeras found the most chaotic force in the universe, demons, the fell energy that they use, and then themselves. And he hammered it into an orderly instrument where it has a chain of command. It has rigid, you know, superiority. You do what you're told. If you don't do what you're told, you pay for it. He made that thing orderly. Mm-hmm. He imposed order over chaos.
Mm-hmm.
The removal of him and his lieutenants has allowed the Legion to become chaotic again. That's why they're not currently a threat. But think about the fact that Sargeras didn't become disorderly. He was still rigidly orderly. He was just applying it in a way that would seem anathematic to other Titans. That means, in some fashion, you might argue that Sargeras had no choice. Mm-hmm. When given the worldview he was given, and we know where he got it from. He got it from his first encounter with the Nathrezim.
Mm-hmm.
Given that order, he had no choice but to do what he did. He's extremely predictable. They're all extremely predictable. That's one of the things the Nathrezim even say. When you read that, the uninvited guest, the unseen guest, they point out that the Titans are exceptionally orderly and easy to manipulate. You can predict what they will do as long, you know, you give them a certain piece of information, you can predict what they'll do with it. That's why they're very, very vulnerable to the old gods. That's why they're vulnerable to the Fel. They can't predict what the Fel will do, and they have no idea what the old gods are up to. When presented with the old gods, they built a facility to attempt to study them.
Yeah, that's the whole point of Mother.
They couldn't understand them. Now, imagine Azeroth in a similar situation. She doesn't have what we have. She doesn't have free will. We have the curse of flesh to thank for a lot of the things that have affected the mortal races of Azeroth. Can a Titan go through that process? Can a Titan acquire free will? Do they have it? That's something to consider.
And is
the
that
process of corruption for a Titan might very well be the gaining of free will.
I was just going to say that, imply?
What would that imply? What would a Titan with free will be? Because the Titans we've seen up to this point, it's not just that they have their special powers like life and time and all that. They have a role to play in the Pantheon. But there's no Pantheon anymore for Azeroth to interact with. There's no order for her to be a part of. She's the last one. The final Titan. And she's been rebuilt. Like, you know, we must rebuild the final Titan. What is she going to be? What is a Titan that doesn't have that rock certain order? Every Titan we've ever met, for all we know, they could still just be the nascent first stage in development of entities that are far, far greater. I mean, you look at the Pantheon of Death, who are said to be on the Titans' levels or even beyond them, and they clearly have more motivations. Like, look at Sire Danathrys.
Yeah,
look
he's at a perfect example of that, yeah.
Is that because they've been through the next stage of development?
Are they the next stage of development?
We don't know. We have no idea. But the idea of corruption needs to be really thoughtfully considered here. What does it actually mean? To quote another video game, redemption in of itself is kind of a spiritual collapse. It's a giving up. And Sargeras never gave up. There's no redemption for Sargeras because he still believes he's right. And given the information he has, he is right. The old gods cannot be stopped, and they will corrupt the universe as far as we can tell. There's nothing yet that's proved effective. We don't even know if blowing up Yogg-Saron with a reorigination device did anything to him.
It could have done nothing at all.
Yeah, or it could have actually been exactly what he wanted. We don't know. But that's the thing to consider in all of this. Do we know for sure that Titans can be corrupted? No, we do not know that. We do not know that they can't be either. And considering what they can do, it's probably not a good idea to find out. So that's pretty much the end of my answer on this one.
And I would agree. And I think it all boils down to the same thing. Adjust how you think about the term corruption. And I think it frames everything ever so differently. The second question from Matt here, if Sargeras is allowed to take the sword out of the planet, either by slowly shrinking it or pulling it out, would the wound, if contained, become something similar to the Well of Eternity? What is the difference, if any, between what came from the wound created by Yash-Raj and what may come up if the sword is ever removed? And before you guys start asking why Sargeras would remove the sword, that isn't the question. The question is, what if he did? And there's
what makes you think he can? Is my follow-up to that. If you're going to tell me I can't ask one question, I'm going to ask you a different one. How do you know he can remove that sword? How do you know what that sword was for? Like, just because it's a sword doesn't mean he was trying to kill anything. And that's something I keep thinking about. When he put it in, there's that whole bit where you're forced to go and use your artifact to draw out the quote-unquote, cosmic poison from it so it can't hurt Azeroth, and in the process destroying a whole bunch of artifacts. Why did he do that? What was he trying to do? Because here's the thing, he killed one world. He destroyed one world soul. Sargeras, in fact, is the only person we know of to have successfully killed a world soul. Why did he not do it this time? The stabbing the planet did not have to be what he did. When he destroyed that planet, he cut it in half with his sword. He could have done that to Azeroth. Why didn't he? When he got here, he did not attempt to destroy Azeroth. Now, Joe already pointed out, you know, he was trying, there were multiple times where it was hinted that he was attempting to turn Azeroth to his side. The whole thing with the jeweled scepter, Sargeras talks about his desire for Azeroth. He may have been looking for a mate. He may have been jealous because the other Titans were like, "No, no, this one will become the most powerful Titan ever," implying, "And you won't be anymore." So he might have been jealous. There's a lot of potential possibilities behind what Sargeras was after. In terms of if we even accept he could remove the sword, why do we know it's he's going to remove it? For all we know, Azeroth is going to remove it.
Mm-hmm.
He may have been attempting to give Azeroth his sword. Because she's going to need it.
And if you think about it from that perspective, too, Azeroth is in a lot of ways a combination of all of the Titans. So we don't know what form Titanic, like, shaping of a world really, really takes anywhere else, because we haven't really been privy to it. But at least on Azeroth, there, I think there's an argument to be made that with the dragon flights in particular and how they were empowered, with how Azeroth has been shaped, it's with the influence of pretty much all of the Titans. And in some aspects, it's almost as if each of the Titans has given her an aspect of themselves. Whether it was Amon Thul and keeping the time ways clear specifically for Azeroth, because we don't hear about that happening anywhere else with a bronze dragon flight. You have one that has the Emerald, basically governorship over nature and the Emerald Dream, and making sure that things stay pure. You have one that's a guardian of life. You have one that's a guardian of the deep ways and the earth, whether or not, you know, they're still around what they did before that. That's all debatable. And you have one that takes care of all the ley lines and power and magical energy. These are curators. These are aspects of the Titans essentially given form to help shape the planet. That always stuck with me a little bit. And when you go back to Sargeras, Sargeras was the warrior. Not just the warrior, because Agrimmar was as well. But
he was it was basically Sargeras as the one in charge and Agrimmar as his assistant.
Exactly.
Knight and Squire.
Yeah.
Knight and Squire, basically.
So what if that was, and you make a really good point. This is something I've thought about off and on. What if that wasn't him saying, I'm going to kill Azeroth. This is my time is done. There's nothing else I can do. I see the writing on the wall. I need Azeroth to have a weapon that I know can cleave the void in twain. And so instead of trying to kill or hurt or maim, maybe he was just trying to crack the egg. Maybe he was trying to get her to wake up and take the sword up, because if she is supposed to be the last Titan, and maybe Sargeras knows this, maybe he understands that prophecy. Maybe he understands everything about that to a certain degree that maybe we don't, because we don't know what he's learned over all this time.
We only know that at the big confrontation between the Titans and Sargeras, when they went to that planet and had their big meeting that ended up with, you know, in destruction, we know that they told him that they'd found this world and this world had overcome the void, that it was possible, because he didn't believe it was possible. The information had never been vouchsafed to him until that point. And he didn't take it well, obviously, based on the slaughter that then happened. So we don't really know what his intent is. In terms of what you're asking, in order for the wound to become like the Well of Eternity, you need a whole bunch of Titan Forged shaping it. Because that's what happened with the Well of Eternity. The Well of Eternity wasn't just the gaping wound caused when Amon Thul pulled out Ysraj. It was then everybody got together, after they defeated the other old gods and locked them away, they got together and created a network of sites across the planet. And one of the things that network of sites did was channel the energy from the wound back into Azeroth. The Well of Eternity, for all the power that it leaked out into the world around it, most of that power was going straight back down into Azeroth. It was healing her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. We don't have an army of Titanforged able to build a worldwide network over the course of centuries to create something like the Well of Eternity again.
Heck, that network isn't even connected anymore. The closest we've gotten to it was when we were trying to fire the origination beam or re-origination beam. And even then, not all of the facilities are connected because Alduar...
Some of them don't even exist anymore.
Yeah, some of them don't exist anymore. Alduar said no. They can't even leverage what was already there.
And what was already there was built around the well, not the wound in Silithus.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the wound in Silithus is very close to the heart chamber, which, if he was trying to destroy Azeroth, that's probably a good move. But if he was trying to do what Joe suggested and get Azeroth to get up, you might want to hit the heart chamber. Because with the heart chamber gone, that's the governor. That's the thing that keeps that whole system in going.
Yep.
And as long as that system's going, Azeroth is dependent on it. If you want to get Azeroth to get up, you might have to take out that last bit of the system, which utterly did not happen. So, ironically, we, in all of our efforts to save Azeroth, we may be keeping it in the world. We may be keeping it in check.
Yeah, I this is going to sound really goofy, but I always think about this in terms of something similar to, and I hate bringing up 40K all the time, but it always reminded me of sort of like the Emperor on the Golden Throne thing. It was this thing where it kept him in a permanent amount of stasis. You sacrificed a whole bunch of power to it to keep it running, and it was an archaic system that nobody really truly understood, and now the story there is already evolving into, well, maybe the fact that you've had this cosmic being that could regenerate itself or heal itself or be better on essentially a form of stasis is not the best idea. And that was always something that I've been considering since we started learning about the Titan facilities is, what if that was a mistake? What if that was
it just... might have been something too. I mean, even if it wasn't a mistake, it might have been something that was necessary
at the time,
you know, eons ago. But since then, it's now, it's like you put somebody into the system, and then now the system has been so thoroughly messed up mm-hmm. that it's doing more harm than good. That's possible. We don't really know. But we do know that, it's not going to turn into the Well of Eternity. In terms of what is coming out of it, is it different than what came out? No, it's not. It's the life essence of Azeroth. The difference is this time it's just uncontrollably bleeding. It's not just coming out of this one area. When he pulled Yashraj out, he made a wound, and the wound is where everything was leaking. But oddly enough, with the sword in the wound in Silithus, it's like it's coming up everywhere else. Because Azerite's not just popping up out of Silithus. It's all over the world. You run into it everywhere. So this is less, like, we have no idea what this ultimately is in terms of its effects on the world.
Yeah.
How bad this wound is. What, you know, Joe mentioned before about how Magni has seen that Azeroth is having nightmares. Azeroth had nightmares about exactly what happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing to consider. Unlike us, Azeroth's nightmares are not just fears that things might happen. Azeroth is a cosmic entity. It gets sense of what's going to happen. That's something to keep in mind. So... No, it wouldn't be like the Well of Eternity, but it is, if in many ways it might be worse, and it might be this that forces the world awake ultimately. Like at one point, back when he still worked there, Dave Kosak made a comment about how Azeroth might never wake up. And since then, you know, obviously he's left Blizzard and they didn't make that canon. We have no idea what's going to happen. If Sargeras was to pull the blade out, we don't know what the result would be. We don't know what the result would be if Azeroth pulled the blade out.
Yeah, I mean, and that, I think that's kind of that's the takeaway. And one of the other things that I've been thinking about it too is, I just going back to like what we were talking about before, we don't know what the purpose of him stabbing it in the first place was. And because we don't understand that, it is very hard to speculate what would happen if the sword is pulled out. Because, again, it's not killing the planet, because fairly confident he could have done that. He had plenty of opportunity to do that. And that's the other thing, too. Like, he was wrapped around Azeroth for a while we were dealing with other things. He had a perfect opportunity to manifest and just cleave the planet, and he didn't. So why? What was he trying to do before that? Was he trying to wake her up? Was he trying to figure out what his family did? Because don't forget, while he understands the Titan facilities, like that they are Titan facilities, he wasn't there when they were built. He wasn't there inspecting them. He doesn't understand necessarily how they all work.
You remember the Titans that built all that stuff were the ones like Amonthul, Ianar, Norgannon's a big guy. Norgannon's really involved in this. Norgannon's the one who builds things. Those are the ones who did it, you know. It was them and their servants that did the work. I mean, their servants did most of the work. They were just in charge of it. This is like, Sargeras isn't a doctor. Imagine if you're like a soldier and you come into a room where doctors in your unit have been working on a guy. You know that they've been working on the guy. But that doesn't mean you know what they did. That wasn't his specialty. That wasn't what he did. So yeah, he might come there and be like, okay, I got to wake this dude up to interrogate him. And there's nobody there to explain to him, no, you can't do that. You know, there's no one there to tell him even how to wake that person up. So, yeah, there's a lot to this. There's a lot of potentials. I don't think, but I think to answer your question, since you did ask a question and I want to answer it, we don't know, but it wouldn't be a Well of Eternity.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And I think we can move on to the third and final question from Matt here. I remember reading a while back, and I don't remember the source, and I'm sorry. The Titans, while they were imprisoning Olgoth, thought C'Thun was dead. While this may answer why the chamber in its raid doesn't look like a Titan facility, doesn't this also mean that if C'Thun isn't dead, according to Cho'Gall talking about his master in the present tense, isn't C'Thun free? If my memory was right about the Titans thinking it was dead, why would they imprison a dead body? And if that bit of history has been changed due to the story updating or whatever, why hasn't there been a bit of lore added in game to explain why this chamber doesn't look like a prison like Yogg's does?
Oh, but this one's easy. No, they didn't. They absolutely didn't think he was dead. They knew that these things couldn't die normally. They're called necrophotic at one point, deathlights. Mm-hmm. They were like, they didn't understand it, but they, like, you know, we tore this one apart and its destroyed body is still doing things. So they knew once they killed Yashraj, they knew none of these things can die normally. We don't understand this. So they locked him up. Cause even if he looked dead at that point, they're like, nope, not taking any chances. So no, to the first part, I don't know where you got that from. That's not part of the lore. In vanilla, there was stuff about
Titan.
In vanilla, there was stuff, and this wasn't from the Titans. This was from people who lived after the Titans,
mm-hmm.
Writing about how a Titan and an old god fought, and the Titan fell. The Titan was supposed to have died. It turned out to be a Titan servant, like a Titan Forge, one of the big, powerful ones. But, you know, like the Master's Glaive up in Ashenwood? Ashenvale? Yeah.
Ashenvale.
Yeah, there's the Titan's Glaive up there. That's not a Titan's Glaive. That's a Titan Forge. And the thing it's in is not an old god. It's an old god servant, one of the Chithraxi. But, I mean, you know, to the people who observed this stuff, okay, that's, you know what I mean? It's like you're telling this person that's not a god. They have no idea. It looks like a god to them. It's like that. That's the story that's in Silithus. It's from various old god worshippers expressing what the little bit that they saw from like visions from their gods. In terms of why it doesn't look right, it's because when C'Thun took over, he began shaping Ankaraj to his liking.
Well, real quick, just to back up before you go into that, Ankaraj was a Titan forged facility that was created during the ordering of Azeroth and was under the purvey of Highkeeper Ra. That was where it originated. Now you can go into the corruption and all that.
Well, yeah, I mean, for that matter, if you'll notice Ankaraj is right next to Uldum.
Yep.
They're right there. They are practically physically connected. You literally go over a hill and you're hitting a Titan facility in Uldum. They're right there. All of Uldum was part of the original origination machine. That's what its function was. AQ was to study the old god. They had him. He wasn't doing anything. They put him in there and they began studying him, just like Uldum, like Uldir. They were studying this thing. And you'll notice Uldir, they weren't studying an old god. They were studying old god essences.
Which so they had to extract it from somewhere.
They were taking samples from all the old gods that they had. They were taking samples from C'Thun. They were taking samples from Yogg. They were taking samples from N'Zoth. And they were taking those samples to Uldir and working on them there. They were, you know, which makes sense. You don't want to work on them right next to the thing. That's why you have containment for a reason. As a result, they created, what's his name? Oh, Gahoon there, the blood god. Literally like a god disease. Like not just a god of disease, literally a disease that is a god. That's what Gahoon is. It's not good, and yikes, that was not good of them to do. Don't do that, guys. But anyway, while that was going on, when C'Thun managed to exert itself and take over the facility, because the Silithid dug into it and became the, you know, that's where the, you remember that the Karaji are descended from the Akir. Mm-hmm. And the Akir and the Naraki are literally exuded from old god bodies. Like, the old gods just give off these things. They just, all the tentacle-faced, faceless ones, the Chithraxi, all that stuff. The old gods exude them. They're like pieces of the old god. And so the Silithid, the actual Silithid, aren't just, they're natural life forms. But the Akir are not. And the Akir corrupted the Silithid when the Silithid came into what is now Ankaraj. And, you know, that whole deal, that whole process, that's what led to the various, the entire reason there's not a big troll empire squatting on Azeroth right now is because they got into a dust up with the Akir. And in the process, splintered the original troll empire into like multiple warring tribes because of the sheer violence of the fight against the Akir. But in the process, they managed to save Azeroth from being destroyed. And keep that in mind. We all owe the trolls for there even being an Azeroth to fight over.
And they say as much. Like, when you go through, like, in Mists of Pandaria, and you go to the temple, why can't I think of it now? What's the name of the raid? With Lay Shen. Throne of Thunder,
okay.
When you do, like, the console fight, like, when you're fighting the individual pieces, like, they talk about that. They talk about, like, their war against the bugs. They talk about that Azeroth owes them and why they want to claim it. Like, that's why they're doing this whole thing. They're like, we should have had this in the first place. We're the reason this planet's in one piece. We're the reason that you all can still breathe. Like, this is our world. And megalomania aside, they're not wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's the reason that they're not still ruling an empire. It's the reason that when the elves came up, the night elves could so easily push them aside because they expended so much of their power and resources on this war. And then in the process, so many troll tribes broke away and started their own empires and their own states that they weren't unified anymore. And there was no way for them to unify against the upstarts. Then the upstarts also were using arcane power, which the trolls had never seen before. Trolls, remember, troll magic was very much about, you know, making deals with spirits, the Loa and so forth. They were not prepared for raw arcane might. They didn't know what to do with it. They've since figured it out, but at the time, they did not have the ability to compete.
Yeah, but going back to the original root of the question, though, like, yeah, it Ankaraj was originally a Titan facility used for the study of, like, in this case, C'Thun. They kept them separated. They kept them apart from each other because putting them together would be a really dumb idea. And it could have also been the impact point of where C'Thun originally landed, because that was the other thing that the old gods were. They weren't exactly mobile. I think N'Zoth is the most mobile out of all of them that we've known, besides G'hoon, which, you know, he never really impact landed. But Yasraj, that he was burrowing into the planet to the point of where he made impact with the planet when he was flung into this universe and burrowing down. We can assume that C'Thun is doing the same, because even when we fight C'Thun, we go into C'Thun's body, which is under that land. It's underground. It's in that chamber below. So we don't know when that Titan, I think, well, we might know now when Highkeeper Ra decided, like, when all that stuff went down and it was no longer there to oversee it. C'Thun begins corrupting,
it's literally the trolls' fault.
Oh, it's the trolls' fault. Go for it.
The trolls, they basically discovered it while they were fighting the Akir. The Akir were trying to get in.
Oh, that's the trolls, right. Yeah.
The trolls basically drive them in. And, you know,
they will come up from hibernation. That's right.
Yeah, and then they're like, yeah, good enough. That's them dealt with. And they just left. And meanwhile, they were like, the Akira were like, oh, it's Yogg-Saron. I mean, it's C'Thun. Let's wake him up. And so it's the troll's fault. So while they did save the world, they did also do that. That's also them. Sorry, guys.
And then which means that they are inadvertently the cause of the War of the Shifting Sands.
Yes.
Which, again, that was another form of containment as well, too, right? So C'Thun at that point was, awake-ish. You have the Karaji, who are also awake, who now begin trying to rampage out from their base of operations, which is now Ankaraj.
Yeah, and you'll also notice that a lot of the stuff that you fight when you go into AQ is Titan-constructed.
It just happens to be molded over with bioorganic stuff.
Well, not all of it. Like, look at Mott.
Yeah.
They have the Obsidian Destroyers. The Obsidian Destroyers are basically just Tolvir. From older.
Well, yeah, which
older.
We know now, yeah.
Not Old War. Uldum. They're from Uldum. Yeah. There's two kinds of old Obsidian destroyers. There's the ones up in Northrend, who were the remnants of Titan of Tolvir that were living in Northrend, who got destroyed or enslaved by the Nerubians. Another group created by the old gods, ultimately, since the Nerubians are descended from the Akir as well. And then there's the ones that were in Uldum, and they had some of those inside Ankh-Morash. And then there's the big ones, like the biggest Anubisath, which, if you look at the Anubisath from AQ, they're practically identical to at least one of the bosses in Halls of Origination.
Mm-hmm.
And so those guys were also Titan constructs that were enslaved as well. That's your evidence. You know, there's no big chains like the ones you see in Alduar, and there's no gigantic, like, you know, mechanism like the one you see in Nazoth's prison at the, you know, when you go to the Ashara's Trumpet Palace, because C'Thun's been out for a while. When you go to Ankh-Morash, C'Thun has had control of that place for millennia. Would you keep your chains around? Why would he want the locks that they once used to lock him up still in his, you know, that's his, he doesn't move, as Joe pointed out. He can't go anywhere. He doesn't physically leave that area. He's certainly not going to have his servants keep those chains there. What if he gets beaten down enough, they could put those back on him. No, get those out of here. I don't want to see those.
And the things that live around that area know that he's there, at least to a certain extent. So they're trying to keep that his influence in check. So unlike Northrend, unlike with Yogg-Saron, where nobody knows that Yogg-Saron is in there, the races that surround that aren't aware of that because nobody talks about it. Like that's a big distinction. Like if you go down to like the Silithus and the surrounding area, you talk to or you go through any of those facilities, the races that still exist there, like the Tolvir, they know he's there. And so they can actively continue to work against outward expression of his power until, you know, we get the whole corruption thing, et cetera, et cetera. But C'Thun doesn't have the same freedom that Yogg-Saron has because of that. Because Yogg-Saron's in an area where nobody knows he's there. He can just do whatever he wants. He can, oh, look, there's Sobrogan of the Fallen Tree. Cool. Here's a little noodly appendage to go say, yep, go do weird, bad things. C'Thun's influence is a little more blunt force trauma than that. So, yeah, it is a fascinating thing, but you always have to keep in mind that Ankh-Morash started as one of the Titan facilities.
Also, to step outside of our lore conversation for a second, the reason it doesn't look the same way is because AQ came out in 2007.
Also true.
No, 2006. Sorry. Maybe even 2005. Yeah, it was 2005. My God. So it came out a lot earlier than, say, you know, Alduar.
I mean, look at Uldum.
They hadn't worked it all out yet. Like the first time we saw Uldum, there was just one doorway in and we couldn't get through it. And that was it. That was all the Uldum we had.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no idea what was going on in there. And I don't know how far in advance Blizzard had this stuff developed, but I am relatively certain that in 2004, when they were, you know, getting ready to release World of Warcraft, they did not know the stuff they were going to be doing later. That's just the way that, you know, group shared universe type stuff works. Think of this as the World of Warcraft is essentially the Warcraft cinematic universe in terms of its lore. Stuff keeps getting added. Stuff keeps getting folded in. When they did AQ, they did not really hadn't thought about exactly how the old gods got to these places. That's something they came up with later. So that's why it doesn't look the same.
So hopefully that answers your questions on those three. Thank you again for providing us with those. It's fun to think about some of that stuff, which we haven't really brought up in a while, especially like the C'Thun things, because I didn't really remember how similar the architecture was in Ankh-Morash after the old god influence to the stuff with the Black Empire nightmare that Nazoth was forming. And it was cool to kind of go back and actually look and compare those two, because there is definitely some shared architecture there. But moving on, our next question comes from our good friend Vertigree. Question for Lorewatch. Have you heard of Turtles All the Way Down? In Corthia, and this has some mild spoilers to it, so if you're avoiding Corthia spoilers, sorry. During the questing, we meet an attendant archivist and her apprentice. She has us visit graves of archivists to communicate with their spirits in order to do a ritual. The ghosts show up to help in order to complete the ritual to imprint a dowsing rod thing with every artifact in her memory. The archivist sacrifices her life and becomes a ghost. She then promotes her apprentice to archivist. Bolvar said he saw worlds within worlds. Perhaps dying as a soul takes you to another Shadowland, and it's Shadowlands all the way down. Maldraxxus doesn't just bring back liches. The House of Rituals beings bring their non-lich servants all the time. The Lich Sworn, and even we do it on a weekly quest, raising skeletons who are either eager to fight again or furious at us. Perhaps the Maw is actually the only place this doesn't happen. After all, it's the only place Stygia and Solash are found. That's a... an interesting point, I think. So, I think we talked about this a little bit before, where, yeah, the only place we see Solash and Stygia is in the Maw, and it's unclear if that is a byproduct of souls dying after they've been given their other life, or if it's an expenditure of that soul being burned out and used as power, albeit, like, from the jailer or aspects like that. So... that is definitely a possibility, and is definitely something we should consider and continue to look at, is what is Solash and what is Stygia.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. We know very little about quote unquote souls in WoW. We know that there are soul engines that the Legion has that apparently destroy souls and use that to create Fel. That Fel is something that can be created by the ultimate annihilation of a soul. We don't know how that works. We don't know if that's the same as what's going on, if that's just one version of what the jailer is doing in the Maw. We don't know if dying is a true... a couple of times they say true death. That's said in various parts of Shadowlands. It's like, mm-hmm. If I have to die, my true death. So there's some sense of, you know, if you die in a Shadowland, you don't come back. That's one of the things that seems to be part and parcel of what's going on, which does beg the question, what is going on in Maldraxxus?
But it's not just Maldraxxus, yeah. It's everywhere.
Yeah, but Maldraxxus is where they're going around doing a lot of lich making and resurrecting. And it is interesting to think about, like, if you die in Maldraxxus and then they raise you, it's like being an undead death knight. Like, you know, are you double juiced in dead? I mean, like, what's happening here? And so that is something to consider. I don't have an answer for you. It is certainly something, it would be kind of interesting to find out that yes, if you die in some Shadowlands, you can end up in other Shadowlands. But that would kind of like, does that mean the jailer sorts your dead self? It's like you die, the jailer sorts you, puts you in Revendreth. You die again. The jailer's like, what? Oh, we guess you don't work in Revendreth. Here's this other Shadowland. You know, does that happen? I don't know. I do not know how this works.
I've always been coming back to the idea of the machinery of death when I start thinking about this, because it's something that was thrown around a lot. It's something that was talked about a lot, and we haven't really done a whole lot with the aspects of that so far this expansion. And yes, we aren't even at the first content patch yet, folks. There's going to be more to come, I am confident. We know, the only thing we know is that when the process was broken, when the quote unquote machinery of death was broken, it seems to be when the Arbiter was knocked out of their position, and can no longer function in a way of telling souls where to go. What is the machinery of death? Why is that such an important thing? Is it what we are experiencing right now? Was it constructed deliberately before the Shadowlands existed, before Ouroboros existed, before everything was happening where people were getting basically sorted out like a sorting hat? What was there? Because there was something before that. At least that we can have some semblance of certainty, because like the ordering of the universe, this seems to be another aspect of the universe that probably got caught up in the ordering. And I always come back to it, like, maybe that's why. Maybe there is no final, like, final death unless your soul is completely used up and burned and repurposed. And the final death to denizens of the Shadowlands isn't necessarily going to another Shadowlands or to another realm of death based off of whatever they did while they were alive in their particular realm of the Shadowlands. Maybe instead it's they lose the identity of self, and that itself becomes a true death to them, because all the creatures, all the entities we interact with have distinct personalities. Even the attendants have roles, and their personalities play into that role, or the role plays under the personality, whichever way you want to look at it. What if to somebody in the Shadowlands, your final death, your true death, is no longer being that person? Now, going back to the Korthia stuff, that is a really interesting point, because we see that everywhere. Every single one of the Shadowlands has an aspect of this. Not all of them are on the nose like Maldraxxus is. And Maldraxxus, even if you don't choose it as your covenant, it's the one of the first things you do is you go to the boneyard, essentially, of failed bodies, and you say, get up, get a sword, here's some anima, you're back, you're off the bench, time to go, you know, take some swings. And they get up and they do it. But what was happening to them before that? Were they just inert? Were they just dead, quote unquote? Or was their power being reserved for something else? And I think there's an aspect to that that we should look at some point, and we probably will as characters in game, as things, I don't want to say start to calm down, but as we start getting to sort of the crescendo of the expansion, I have a feeling that's a question we're going to start asking is, wait a minute, why is this a thing? And I don't just mean just the bodies coming back. I mean Ardenweald and Revendreth and Maldraxxus and Bastion. Why do they exist? Why were they created? Why is Ouroboros a thing? Why is the Arbiter a thing? Because you notice that's a question nobody has asked so far in game. None of the NPCs, none of the major story arcs have asked the question, why is the Arbiter? We just go and help because we're told that that's the way it's supposed to be. And maybe that's what the jailer's been railing against all this time, is that nothing can truly die now. There is no true death. Or maybe that's what Sylvanas saw, and that's what she's railing against a little bit. But Korthia seems to put a little more emphasis on that, because even though the Archivist sacrifices her life, she doesn't really sacrifice her life. She just becomes a part of a different whole by lending her power and knowledge to something else, but still exists as a ghost. And with the Archivists that came before, those ghosts still know who they are. They just don't have the full aspect of their power. Because we can communicate with them. We talk with them. And we call them spirits. But we're essentially just communicating with the essence of their intelligence, of their id. I don't know. Like, it's fascinating because this starts asking more questions about what it means to have an existence in the Shadowlands. And now it makes me start worrying and thinking about things like all those folks that we've come to love in Ardenweald, like Chufa, like the Ursine Protector. I can't remember their name. But now even like Ysera, who is now part of that. What does that mean for them? Is that something that they can never truly escape? Is that something that now that they're a part of it, they can't be sent back? Because that's the other thing, too. Like, think about the Queen's Conservatory. Those spirits are nurtured and powered up and then sent back through a portal. They're gods or powerful beings akin to gods or Loa, and they're sent back through. But what does that mean for everybody else? We don't see quote-unquote mortal souls go back through that. We just see immortal souls go back through that. Why? Is it because once you're born here, you're stuck? And I'm sorry. I know that's more questions than answers to any of it, but I going back to the root of it, I don't think it's Shadowlands all the way down. I think there's more to it, and I think it's questions we're going to start asking. All right. Anything else you want to add to that?
No, I think that pretty much covers it.
All right. I think we have time for one more. This one comes from Jack Jack. Question for Lore Watch. Where in the cosmic alignment do you think Alun is? And how do you see that interacting with Tirand and the power of the Night Warrior? I'm thinking specifically about parallels between her and our friend Yurel. What do you think, Matt?
I think back to the thing we asked before, like, what do you happens if you have a being like a Titan that has free will? And we know that Alun was part of the, when we went through Legion and they had the various, I want to say pillars of creation.
Yeah, pillars of creation.
And when we had them, they were variously, they were related to various Titans, except the tier of Alun. It wasn't a tier of A&R. It was a tier of Alun.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it a bunch of Titans and Alun? Why was Alun involved? When we found A&R, she was on a world called Elunaria. Why? What's up with all this? What is Alun? I don't know the answer to that question, but I do think there's... If you have a being that is not just light and is not just void, you have a Naru. We know that the Naru are apparently affected by the tier of Alun. You bring the tier of Alun to, I want to say, I can't remember her name, the one that was so obsessed with Illidan.
Oh, Maeve.
No.
Or not Maeve.
The Alun, the Naru.
Zira.
Yeah, when Zira is exposed to the Tear of Alun, it reactivates her consciousness core. Why? And we used to joke about the whole Alun is a Naru thing. But think about what it means to be a being that has transcended, you know, your role, that has gone beyond the point where you do what you do because you're an orderly being and you are predictable and you do that. You've gained the ability to think about why you do it and to make your own decisions about it. That being might not belong on some cosmic alignment chart because that being has transcended alignment.
Mm-hmm.
If it can do more than just be a light being or be a void being, because we've now seen that there's a dark side to Alun. The Night Warrior is the eclipse. The moon goes out. The moon is blocked. If you're in Ashenvale right now and you look up, it is Ashenvale. You look up at the sky, the moon is forever floating there in an eclipse form, and it never stops. The day never comes. It's like Shadow Moon Valley. What was Shadow Moon Valley? An eternally dark place because there was a Naru up in the sky that was in its dark phase.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that Alun is a Naru, but I think that saying Alun is a Naru isn't wrong exactly so much as I think it's like trying to understand a person by looking at their toe. The old thing about, you know, a bunch of blind people is an elephant, which I personally find incredibly offensive now that I'm blind. Thanks, guys. But it's still, you know the point. You know, if you're only touching a little piece of it, that's, you know, oh, it's like a snake. It's got this long thing. No. You're looking at her toe, and you think you have the entire being understood.
Yeah.
That's what I think we're dealing with Alun.
This is something I've been thinking about a little bit. Maybe not as much as I would like to, you know, claim I have. But I think you might be on to something with the whole transcended being thing. Let's say that Alun was a Naru at one point. Maybe the first Naru. Maybe the one of which all other Naru are born. Maybe. That's not who Alun is anymore. And looking at all of the aspects of Alun, and there are aspects of Alun, multiple facets of what Alun is that we've seen, and I don't think we've seen all of them, it's almost like Alun has become a transcendent part of reality. Because the power of Alun touches the Emerald Dream, exists in the Shadowlands, seems to touch all of the major spheres of influence, has that dark side, which is almost like its own section of the cosmology. It's almost like Alun is a multifaceted gem that happens when you ascend and truly understand reality. And it's almost in a lot of ways to me, maybe not on the same scale, but you kind of saw that with Yasuraj a little bit. When Yasuraj died, Yasuraj didn't die. Yasuraj actually became greater than. it became different, transcended its old god corporeal form, and became the Shah. And the Shah are vast. The Shah are powerful. And the Shah have accomplished more corruption in subtle ways and more influence than almost any of the old gods have ever claimed to be able to do. Left unfettered, left uncontained, probably could be doing a better job than any of the old gods at corruption. And show them a thing or two. Maybe that also may happen with Alun. If Alun broke in such a way that was no longer what Alun was before, and what we see now is an aspect of order of magnitude greater, which is why there are so many different pieces of her and why Alun touches so many different things.
And exists on so many different worlds.
Uh-huh. You know,
we meet a Night Warrior from one of the first Night Warriors, as far as we can tell, and from a completely different world than Azeroth. I honestly don't think that Alun ever was an Aru. I think that comparing Alun to an Aru is like comparing me to my skin cells as they flake off of me.
Sure.
No, I'm not kidding. Like, I think that's not a joke. I think that that's actually not even close to the level of difference. I think that the Naru are much further below Alun than what I just said about my skin cells and me. I think that but I think that there's a pattern here. Like, I think there's one of the things Joe just mentioned, the Shah are empowered by emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't matter what you do, as long as you know, it's like the one of the reasons the people of Pandaria have learned to folk to keep like control of themselves. They've learned to keep their emotions in check. You can't control yourself from having emotions, but you can keep them from raging freely. You have to control yourself. You have to hold on to your emotions. We don't know what Alun is in terms of what empowers her, if anything does. But we do know that Alun doesn't just go around acting. Like, Alun didn't just blow up the Horde when they were invading, you know, Ashenvale. She didn't just bodily save all those Night Elves trapped on the tree. She let them die. Was it because she couldn't? Now, clearly she had power enough to block out the moon and turn Ashenvale into pure night all the time. But she didn't use it until Tyrande basically demanded she use it. Why? Why is it that Tyrande had to get really mad to get the Alun to act? What does that say about Alun? Alun obviously acts in other worlds, but again, in order to stop the destruction of their world, they had to create a Night Warrior and use that. That's Alun did nothing to the old god on that world until there was a Night Warrior. So does Alun have, like, Alun doesn't know, we don't know that Alun has that kind of personification until somebody comes along and adopts it. And yet we know Alun has like acted in the past. We've seen her when you did that quest back in the old days. This is original WoW quest, so if you're in WoW Classic, you might have got to see it. There's a quest in Winterspring about the Moonkin and where they come from. Alun made them. They exist because Alun wants them to exist, and they used to serve a role.
Mm-hmm.
They would come forth when Alun had something she wanted people to know. They would be there. That's, to me, why did she do that, and then why did she kind of let it go? Like, the Moonkin today don't serve that role. Why not? There's a lot to Alun we don't understand. So I don't think she belongs anywhere on that chart. But we don't know what Alun is enough to really answer it, even if I thought she did belong somewhere.
Fair. And I would agree with that. I think that whatever Alun is transcended whatever the limitations of a standard cosmology chart. So, but I think that's going to do it for us, unless there's anything else you want to add, Matt?
No, I think I've ran on quite a bit there.
Well, thank you very much, folks. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast lighting community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Again, if you have questions for this or the other podcast, be sure to send them in to podcast@BlizzardWatch.com, or you can hit us up on our Discord for the Patreon queue and podcast supporter section, or just the Q question section, and let us know what you want us to talk about. But with that, folks, We'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.